Do you ever hold your arms out and spin around really, really fast?
No, I get vertigo.
Okay, yeah. Hello, everyone. I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chaney.
And this is Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts. This is the podcast where we explore the work of women in film through their catalog of work by genre. Right now, we are concentrating on Sandra Bullock, and it was my turn to draw a genre, and I drew fantasy. So, of course, I chose practical magic.
I would have been mad if you didn't.
It wasn't really my choice. I mean, no. It was my choice, but...
You had no choice.
But really. I had no choice.
You had yes. No choice. This is my all-time favorite Sandra Bullock movie.
I did not realize that.
Yes. I don't know whether it's the sister element. I don't know whether it's just the female empowerment. I don't know whether it's Sandra Bullock herself, because I just finished watching the movie. I've seen it, I don't even know how many times, and I still cried about 4 times. She just hits my heart, and I can't help but empathize with her, and she's just acting. That's how good she is.
Oh, yeah. The part where she's begging her aunts to bring her husband back to life is just so heartrending. Yes, she's wonderful, and I'm so excited to cover this movie. I had a really, really good time researching this movie. At first, I didn't find a whole lot, but then... As I kept digging, I found some stuff that I'm really excited to talk about.
I'm really excited to hear about it.
Yeah. My sources are Insider, Entertainment Weekly, Vulture, the Roger Ebert website, and Wikipedia. And there might be some other ones in there that I failed to put down on this document. But
hey, you put down more than I do. I normally just do a blanket gratitude. Thanks. So, you know, you're doing really okay.
Yeah, thanks, Internet. Mm-hmm. See, I think that this movie, for some reason, hasn't had the same kind of anniversary reunion that a lot of the other movies that we've covered have had. So there weren't a lot of interviews. I found a really long interview with Stockard Channing. It's really funny. I get Stockard Channing, Carol Channing, and Channing Tatum like kind of all overlap in my mind.
Sorry. Channing Tatum? The man.
I don't know who he is. I just know the name. So like I said, it's just like me making these word associations, and they all played Rizzo.
Channing Tatum played Rizzo?
I can't remember who is who is my thing.
Well, Channing Tatum, he is a beautiful man, and he was in She's the Man with Amanda Bynes.
Okay.
You've seen that movie. I've made you watch that movie.
Yes, you've made me watch that movie.
Yeah, he's in that.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, sometimes I can't always relate names to faces, so all of them were Stockard Channing to me.
Well, maybe I know who they all are because their names are so similar to my own that I just kind of gravitated towards them, and I'm like, oh, I want to know you. So,
you know, that makes perfect sense. Whereas I didn't find a really great interview with Sandra Bullock, I want to start with her because this podcast is about her work, so seems like the right thing to do.
Well, and who knows, maybe in what year is it, 21? Maybe in 7 years we'll get a 30-year reunion.
Maybe, and that would be awesome. But coming into this movie, she had recently come away from Speed 2, which was considered a massive bomb.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
I'm intending it for you.
Thank you, because I did intend it, I just didn't know that I intended it. So, yes, and I think a big part of why it failed was that, you know, the boat just wasn't as exciting as a speeding bus. But she came away from that movie with a new mentality on how she wanted to approach the movies that she decided to attach herself to. And she decided that she no longer wanted to make attempts at huge blockbusters, but instead find projects that interested her personally. The first led to her involvement in, can you guess?
Hope Floats.
Hope Floats, yes. And then secondly with?
Practical Magic.
Absolutely.
Look at me. I know things.
You are so good at this Mad Lib.
Thank you.
Okay, so now you know that Practical Magic is an adaptation of a book but with the same name by Alice Hoffman, yes?
I did not.
Okay, well, I just read this book for the first time at the end of 2020. It's one of the most beautifully, lyrically written books I've read in a very long time, and I absolutely loved it.
Are you going to mail it to me so I can read it?
Yeah, I could do that.
Yeah, do that.
I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the book, but I will say it is very different from the movie. There's not as much magic. Mm. There's much less of the ants. Mm. The bulk of the book does not even take place in the aunt's house, and there's a lot more of the little daughters.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I really do like how they upped the antage.
I think that might be the title of this episode.
They up the antage in the movie because they're so wonderful.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
Their chemistry, fun stuff. You know what I should have said? Up the ante, because that's actually what it is.
Yeah. Too late now.
Too late now.
Okay, so this movie was released in October of 1988. It had a budget of $75 million, but it only made $46.6 million domestically. It only made altogether $68.3 million. So it was considered a flop. Now, the way I found it explained is that it actually opened at number one in the box office. And after that, it only tapered off only slightly in attendance in the following weeks. But apparently, October is kind of a lousy time to release movies in the theaters because it exists in kind of a financial nadir between the lucrative summer movie release schedule and the end-of-year holiday season. Like I mentioned before, the critics didn't really like it.
Well, they're silly. You hear that, critics? You're silly.
So it is massively beloved as a cult classic. Mm-hmm. But pretty universally panned by critics. It has a 22% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes and 46% approval rating on Metacritic, which just blows my mind.
I honestly don't know what all that means. So
it means like out of 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, it only has 22%.
Okay, internet, you're also silly. People, yeah. You're silly. This movie is, it is magic. It is magic.
I know. Because I was curious, I read a few of the reviews.
Okay.
And here is what I think may have happened. Just follow me on this.
I will follow you.
The movie is about women and their bonds with one another.
Right.
It's a predominantly female cast. Mm-hmm. And any man in the film is just an accessory to their story. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of the opposite of how a lot of movies are. Mm-hmm. Right. This movie does pass the Bechdel test. Are you aware what that is?
I've heard of it before, but I don't recall what it is.
So, it is when a movie has at least two female characters that have an interaction where the subject of their conversation does not revolve around the men in the movie. If a movie meets that criteria, then it passes the Bechdel test. Mm. I think we probably should have mentioned it before now on this podcast about women in film. But heretofore, I think we probably should acknowledge whenever we do cover a movie that does not pass.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So the critics at the time were mostly men. And because of certain themes, Practical Magic was often compared to Thelma and Louise, which is considered a significant landmark of feminist film. Now, what I believe happened after reading some of these reviews is that because of those themes, you know, it was thought like, Practical Magic is a work of feminist art, so we're going to take out our intellectual spectacles and put Practical Magic on the lofty pedestal of feminism, and we're going to pick it apart from here and point out all the things they did wrong and why it's not a very good representation of feminist art.
Yes, men, please tell us why it's wrong.
Yeah, instead of just letting it be a story about women.
Yeah.
Just relax.
We should have a slice of life films too, you know?
Slice of life with magic?
Yeah, slice of life with magic.
Yeah, so to illustrate this thesis, I actually want to present a couple excerpts from a review written contemporaneously with the release of the film. And I want to get your reaction to this.
Okay, I'm ready to react.
Okay. So I've got two excerpts from this. The first one's a little long. Bullock, as a reluctant spellcaster, and Nicole Kidman as her sorceress sister, sport long, flowing, hippie wave tresses, earnest brown for Bullock, fiery red for Kidman, and neither actress really has much to do apart from standing around and looking terrific under all that hair. Pop culture witch fables like The Witches of Eastwick or The Craft tend to be amusing schlock entertainments that flirt with cartoon feminism. The most ingenious and subversive of the lot was probably the legendary sitcom Bewitched, which had the clever idea of making Samantha's domestic life with its literally interchangeable Darrens silly and innocuous on purpose. When Elizabeth Montgomery twitched her nose in flirtatious triumph, she was the 60s woman as secret goddess of her own domain. In Practical Magic, Sandra Bullock is the goddess of mopey high school whining.
High school mopey whining?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, there's a lot to digest there. One, why can't girls have nice hair?
Right.
Two, you know, The Craft is its own movie. There's so much to unpack here. They're putting all of these things that have nothing to do with each other together and comparing them.
They're taking everything that have to do with witches, saying that if it's a movie or entertainment that centers around witches, there's some kind of feminist aspect to it. And then saying why this was just kind of lame and this was successful. And it seemed like the only thing that this reviewer really liked was the Bewitched show.
Okay, moving on. Okay,
now here's the other one. And this is the one that makes me really angry.
Oh, no.
It did make me really angry talking about that they have nothing to do except look great under all of that hair.
So what? They look great. But both of them do such an amazing job. I mean, Nicole Kidman, when she is dying, it's just so, leave me. He just let him have. It's just so good. And then Sandra Bullock the whole time makes me want to cry. That's not playing mopey. That's not a mopey high schooler. That's emoting.
It's an emotional richness.
Yes. This person just seems like their emotional intellect is not very high. That's what it seems like.
Right. So here's the second one. In a scene that's too embarrassing to be dull, the four get drunk on margaritas and parade through the house dancing funky to that tropical 70s novelty hit, Coconut. The witch sisters get empowered, all right, into wild and crazy girls.
Okay. One, they were getting drunk. People get silly when they get drunk. Two, how dare you, sir? Okay. And anybody that I talk to about this movie immediately all start singing that song.
Right.
It's one of the most iconic moments in the whole movie. Everybody wants to have midnight margaritas. In fact, while I was watching it this time, I was like, man, I wish I had grown daughters my own age so that I could have midnight margaritas and we could all live in a house together and I could wake them up with a blender.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I read the whole review to Ilya last night, my housemate, and at the end she said, "What man wrote this?" And I was like, "Precisely,
sir. You can take your review and put it in a blender with some lime and some coconut, and
call the doctor in the morning."
Yeah,
I was really looking forward to talking about that because I feel like this is why we started this podcast. We wanted to talk about the way that women in film were treated.
Yes.
And here's just this really great example of how like this movie that is centered around women was not respected.
No.
Or even given a chance, really.
No, I mean, if you break down that scene, one of the things that most people do, not everybody does this, but a lot of people do, is they drink to get together to commiserate, to have fun, to connect with each other. That's all those women were doing. They were having a bonding experience. And to trivialize it and say that they just became
wild and crazy girls.
Yeah.
Not even women.
It's so belittling and demeaning. And I guarantee you that that guy goes and has drinks with his friends.
And guffaws and makes horses asses of themselves.
Yes. As Sandra Bullock says in Demolition Man, you can take your review and shovel it.
Very good. That was awesome, Chaney. I applaud you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so I just have a couple more things that I want to remark on before we dive into the movie, because, of course, I've got some facts to sprinkle in later. But firstly, let's talk about the soundtrack.
This kiss, this kiss. That's another song that people start singing automatically when we start talking about this movie.
It's great that you brought that up, and you'll find out after I read this little blurb from Roger Ebert.
Okay. All right. Faith Hill, you're great.
Okay. Okay. Remember that critics didn't like this movie. So right. Just prepare yourself for that. Okay. The movie doesn't seem sure what tone to adopt. Veering uncertainly from horror to laughs to romance to cue us, it puts a lot of songs on the soundtrack. A movie lacks confidence when it uses music to tell us how to feel. Here the music intrudes, insists, explains, and tries to force segues between events that are not segueable. Example, early in the film, an impending kiss is accompanied by This Kiss by Faith Hill.
I have no problem with it. I don't think that it's telling the story. I think that it's accompanying it. And that song in itself fills me with such joy, and I think of this movie and how she has that moment of happiness. Also, her hair looks great when she jumps up into his arms and they start kissing. She does have great hair in this movie. But I have no problem with the song. It does not bother me there. I think it goes perfectly well with the moment.
Yeah, honestly, like, I notice the soundtrack, but it's not distracting from what happens. And I never feel like, how am I supposed to feel in this scene? Let me check the soundtrack.
No. The only time that the music got distracting for me was, and I think they use either two or three of Stevie Nicks songs. Mm-hmm. And Stevie Nicks has such a distinct voice that it's distracting for me because I start listening to Stevie Nicks instead of paying attention to the plot. But that's about it.
So I have like something interesting to say about the soundtrack, which is really why I brought it up. Okay. Apparently, the original print of the movie was much darker.
Okay.
With the original orchestrated sections that were not the pop songs, scored by composer Michael Nyman. But the producers saw the movie and was not happy with the tone. So they had it re-edited to be more lighthearted. But they had already printed the soundtrack with Nyman's original score. So you can actually find both soundtracks.
Okay.
Sadly, the original director's cut was lost. Oh, so
we'll never see the darker version.
We'll never see the darker version. And I find that tragic.
That is really sad. That's tragical magic.
That's tragical magic. Okay. And the final thing. I just wanted to add this because I found this in one of the interviews and I found it really heartwarming. It actually made me cry, especially like learning that this movie just didn't do very well and was treated really poorly by critics. So the movie found its true audience in home entertainment. And years after the release of the film, the director Griffin Dunn's teenage daughter discovered the movie and watched it with her friends. And he got to hear them quoting and reenacting the scenes of the movie. And he said that over the years, he has watched the film's reputation grow and grow, and it's been very touching and unexpected.
Good. I mean, it kind of reminds me of Labyrinth in that respect, that, I mean, Jim Henson never got to see the success of the movie because...
I know, it's so sad.
Yeah, when it came out, it was a flop, but it's become a cult classic now. And I'm really glad that this movie, that director particularly gets to see that his movie is actually getting the recognition and the love that it deserves because it is a beautiful film.
I agree. So let's just dive right in.
Let's get into this.
So we start with the curse.
With Maria.
Find out that the Owens family has been cursed because one of their ancestors was a witch and was persecuted by the community that she was in. But she was in love, but she was jilted. In her grief, she, I guess, cast a spell that she would never fall in love again. But it was her emotions were so powerful that it became a curse that continued through the generations for all women in her family.
How terrible is that, man?
I know.
Like, I'm so bitter that my ancestors will never be happy either. That's just awful.
I got the impression she didn't do it on purpose.
No. No, I bet she feels bad.
I bet she feels bad. I agree. Right. The sisters, Sally and...
Jillian.
Their father dies. What happens to their mother?
She dies of a broken heart.
So they're left as orphans. They go and stay with their aunts in the town that their ancestor had originally come from.
It's an island of some sort.
Yeah.
It's beautiful there. So I saw this on, I think it was on Facebook, that house was actually for sale recently.
That's very interesting because the house...
Isn't real.
Isn't real.
I think we've talked about this before. Maybe we didn't. But would you, if you could, would you buy an old Victorian house and live with your friends or your sister?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. An old Victorian house with all of the hard oak wood is my dream home and always has been.
Can I just say, the moment when Sandra Bullock leaves the house after she has her fight with Jillian and she breaks that glass on the door, that mm-hmm. hurts me because that wasn't normal glass. That was some sort of like hammered glass that was so pretty and I'm sure really, really expensive.
But it was probably actually sugar.
Probably.
But made to look really, really expensive.
Right, because the house isn't real.
Right,
I'm
right.
Sorry if that hurts people's hearts. It hurts mine a little bit because it's a cool house, but it's not real.
I'm glad that you brought that up because I had this at the top of my notes here. It was a shell that was built for the movie, and when the movie was over, they had to tear it down. And all of the rooms are on sound stages. But here's the thing for anyone that feels a little resentful that they were duped and believed it was a real house, because Barbara Streisand also believed it was a real house, and after she saw the movie, called up the studio wanting to purchase it.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, that right there should have been the review. Barbara Streisand saw this movie and liked it so much that she wanted to buy the house that it centered around. There's your ticket sales.
That should have been the review, the end.
Poor Barbara.
Yeah.
I'm sure she found a great house.
Yeah, I'm sure she has a fine house.
Decent at best.
So the next thing that I have to talk about is when the aunts are talking to Sally and how she's saying that she just wants to be normal. She's an adult. Mm-hmm. Right. And they point to a couple walking down the street and they're like, look at them. He's having an affair with the babysitter and she can eat a pound cake in under a minute. And I just want to say, I don't see how those are equatable flaws, because I think that eating a pound cake in under a minute is an impressive skill. And I think that she would be a shoe-in winner at a county eating contest.
Hands down.
Hands down.
A pound cake in a minute?
Yeah.
Those are dense, aren't they?
They are.
You need some milk with that.
You need lots of milk. Yeah, I mean, have you ever seen an eating contest? They're really gross.
Oh, yeah. Dipping whole hot dogs in water to... Oh.
Yeah. I think that to eat a pound cake in a minute at an eating contest, you would probably soak the pound cake in milk and drink it.
Yeah, you'd have to. At least that's sweet. Dipping a hot dog in water just makes me want to vomit. If you had to do a eating contest, what would your food of choice be?
Oh, gosh. Maybe pumpkin pie.
Ooh.
That one is messy anyway. Uh-huh. And so no one's really going to judge you for getting it all over your face. And you're not going to make it any grosser by putting water on it or anything like that. It's just... It already is the consistency it needs to be to eat it quickly.
Yeah, I think that pies or like a cheesecake is the way to go.
Yeah, although I never want to participate in an eating contest ever. That is just not a thing I want to experience in life.
I'd do it. But it would have to be the right food.
Some celery?
I eat really fast. I'm a fast eater anyway, so I would want to put my skills to the test.
Do you think you could eat a pound cake in under a minute if it were made of broccoli?
So what you're asking is, can I eat a pound of broccoli in a minute.
Is that what I'm asking? I don't know.
I like broccoli. I can make it work. I'd make it work. Okay, back to the subject.
Right. So she meets her husband. They fall in love. It's great. It's this kiss and whatever. And then she starts hearing the Death Watch beetle, which is supposed to be part of the curse.
She hears the beetle. She tries to catch it. It falls under the planks and she starts prying up all the boards, which is so frustrating and so... But what would happen if she got a hold of that beetle?
I don't know.
If she smooshes it, then does she smoosh her husband? Or if she keeps it in a bottle and just makes sure it stays in the bottle, is he forever protected? Or would another beetle come in and then that become the death? Like, I'm confused about this curse and what she was trying to achieve.
I don't think it was really a rational action to be taking to try to find the beetle, because I think the beetle is kind of just the messenger, right?
Right.
You know, the whole thing, like, don't kill the messenger. It's just, I'm just doing my job, lady. Chirp, chirp. Chirp, chirp. I actually looked up the death beetle on Wikipedia. The Death Watch beetle is a species of wood-boring beetle. You don't hear them in newer buildings because they're made out of softwood. Old buildings are made out of oak, which is what the beetles prefer. To attract mates, the adult insects create a tapping or ticking sound. Therefore, the Death Watch beetle is associated with quiet, sleepless nights, named for the vigil being kept beside dying or dead. By extension, a superstition has grown up that these sounds are an omen of impending death.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you hear it on the beach like their mother did, that's a pretty good indication that trouble is on its way when it's not supposed to be there.
Because they don't like sand.
Yeah.
Exactly. What next?
Sandra Bullock finds out that the ants pushed her towards her husband, that they gave her a little nudge, that they didn't think that she was actually going to fall in love. And I understand their hearts were in the right place. They wanted to just, you know, give her a little slice of happiness. They didn't think it was going to turn into love. They thought everyone was going to be safe, whatever. Even if they just, like, loved each other and didn't get married, that's still, people still get hurt.
Yeah, that's meddling.
Even if the chance of them getting together was, like, minute, they know that if she really loves him, he is going to die. That is part of their history, their heritage, is that men die. So they sentenced that man to his death.
Right. Well, but even later on in the movie, they talk about how they don't really believe in the curse. Mm. Even though, like, gosh, what are the ants' names?
Ant 1 and Ant 2.
So Ant 1, like, her husband died. And she was like, but it was like a blah, blah, blah. And she's like,
it was fate. It was destiny. It was fate.
Right. I don't know. That's a tough one.
Tough one. They killed him.
I guess it's not so tough. Hey, why did you pause it?
Potty break.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Don't go too far. We'll be right back. Enjoying Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts? Feel free to leave us a review.
Tell us what you love.
And if you must, tell us what you don't love.
I don't love mayonnaise.
I mean about the podcast.
Right.
Contact us through Twitter, Instagram, or email.
Find our handles on our website, www.twosisterspresent.com.
You can also join our Patreon with exclusive content and access to picking your own movie or artist for us to cover.
What? You can pick the next America Sweetheart?
Sure can. Find out all the info at www.patreon.com/twosisterspresent.
Thank you and goodbye.
Later. In a time when quarantine cabarets and digital performances are widespread and flourishing, chances are you've needed backing tracks, especially for those songs that might not be as mainstream. Well, the great people at Let's Play It Recordings have got you covered. Your on-demand digital accompanist and orchestra.
For over 10 years, Let's Play It has been providing performers and organizations around the world with professionally produced backing tracks for study, auditions, demos, and more. Ranging from piano accompaniment to fully orchestrated instrumentals and specializing in productions that are less commercially available.
They even offer customer orders.
If you've got sheet music and need it recorded, they're here to help, along with a large catalog of their own material available for production.
All backing tracks are studio quality, catered alongside friendly customer service, and all at affordable prices with you, the performer, in mind.
So head over to letsplayitrecordings.com to see and hear for yourself. Take a look at their catalog, hear backing track samples, see all of their production services, and request your order today. Mention Two Sisters Present, and you'll even get 10% off your order.
That's letsplayitrecordings.com, your digital accompanist and orchestra. Ready?
Oh, super ready.
3, 2, 1, go. So then, you know, we kind of check in with Jillian.
Yeah.
Who ran away from home a long time ago.
Yeah.
Thrill seeking.
Tired of being in the town where everybody hates them. Okay. Can we talk about the children real fast? The town children.
Yeah, and their foul mouths?
Yeah. So when you watch their mouths, it says, which witch, you're a witch. But audibly, that is not what they're saying. They're saying, which witch, you're a... And that's what the captions say, too. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I would want to get away from that, too. That's mean. And throwing rocks?
It is mean. It's extreme bullying.
You know what? Sandra Bullock's little girl, played by, I think it's Rachel Evan Woods.
Yes.
When Rachel Evan Woods points and says, I hope you get the chicken pox, they deserve it.
Oh, absolutely. And plus, like, what's wrong with that mom saying, your daughter started it? Like, who cares? Like, there's a mob forming around them. Who cares what the daughter might have done? Like, the reaction of all those kids, absolutely 100% inappropriate, and there are no excuses for it.
Yeah. How do you have the audacity to be like, well, those little girls that are defending themselves are the ones that started it?
Victim blaming, yeah.
Anyway, so Jillian wants to get away from town, so she and Sandra Bullock have their little blood oath.
Yes, it's gross. So gross. I don't like it.
They're sisters. It's better that way, I guess.
It's important later on.
Yeah.
But on all of her adventures, she ends up with two words. Jimmy. Angela.
Angela.
Oh my gosh, what an unhealthy relationship.
To say the least.
She drugs him, which is already like a sign that she has to drug him in order to go visit her sister.
No, she has to drug him to go to sleep.
Yeah, we find that out later. But, you know, she goes to visit her sister because her sister's struggling after losing her husband. And she's lounging in front of the fireplace and she's talking about Jimmy Angelov. And she says, sometimes we stay up all night worshiping each other like bats.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I thought that was a really weird line. So I looked it up. And sure enough, bats form monogamous relationships and bring little gifts of food to place at each other's feet. Now, the bats have to catch it really quickly because gravity doesn't allow those little presents to stay at their feet for long, you know, since they hang upside down.
Okay. I think it's funny that you did the research because...
I'm just kidding. I made that up.
Oh, did you really?
I made it up. I was just like, this line is so strange. Like, how can I make sense of this line?
Okay, I did make sense of it, and I didn't have to create a story.
Okay.
It still is bizarre. The way that the line order is, what it's referencing is like five lines before it. So it just seems like it doesn't make sense. But she says he's from, I can't remember where, outside of Transylvania. He's some sort of... something mixed with Dracula. And then they talk more and then say, we worship each other like bats. So I think that it was a reference to his Transylvania Dracula.
Sexy vampire
thing.
Okay.
That's really funny. Are bats even monogamous?
I don't know.
I'm looking that up right now.
I thought you would catch on when I said that they have to catch it really quickly.
I thought that was a joke, but I didn't realize that you were lying the whole time. Okay. Are bats monogamous? Ba-ba-da-da-da. Most species of bats are promiscuous and will mate with multiple partners.
That doesn't mean that they don't bring little gifts to those they're trying to woo.
In some cases, one or two males will acquire and defend a small harem of females.
And then they're catching all sorts of gifts all the time.
But that's very much Jimmy Angelov. I mean, I don't know whether he had multiple partners, but he definitely was territorial defended his claim.
Yeah. I did look up belladonna just to see what it was.
Uh-huh. Poison?
It's a poison. It's a deadly nightshade that belongs to the same family as potatoes and tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
Its berries are extremely toxic and can cause hallucinations. Pharmacologically, something extracted from the belladonna plant can be used to treat vertigo, respiratory problems, gastrointestinal disorders, and insomnia. But if there's anything that we could take away from this movie, it can be a very dangerous plant.
Yes, I would say if you want to use belladonna, do your research and probably go to a doctor first.
I think I also remember learning that in the Renaissance period, women would have tinctures of belladonna. I think it was belladonna that they would put into their eyes because it would cause their eyes to dilate. Mm. And that was thought to be really attractive. So it was like this weird thing that they did cosmetically.
Beauty knows no pain.
I didn't look that up to make sure that it was belladonna. God, but
you are just spouting off all sorts of lies today. Let's see. Belladonna.
Yeah, how will you trust anything that I say now?
No idea. Renaissance. It is named belladonna for the beautiful women of the Renaissance Italy who took it to enlarge their pupils, which they found more alluring.
See?
Okay. I can trust you again. Well,
okay, you can trust about me 50, again.
50-50.
Okay, well, that's good, because the next thing I have to say, unless I'm skipping ahead of things that you want to talk about, is the ring around the moon.
Oh, blood on the moon.
Yes, and how that's a bad omen in mm-hmm. this movie. So I decided to look that up and see what superstition might actually be attached to that. And it turns out that it has a long history of superstition, but it's mostly positive.
Oh, okay.
So a ring around the halo is, in real life, is caused by light refracting off of ice crystals in the air.
Huh.
So the superstition, like, there might have been a cause and effect here. Whenever one were to see a ring around the moon, it was a sign that rain would soon come.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so I really like the way that the ring around the moon is used in this movie. It's very ominous and mm-hmm. creepy, but it has no basis in, as far as I could tell, has no basis in actual superstition.
Well, but maybe it has a basis in Wiccan culture.
Maybe. I did not come across anything. Are you looking it up?
I'm looking up everything. I want to know things.
Signs of a Curious Mind. And I'm sure you know this, but the song that Jimmy Angelov sings,
"You were always on my mind.
You were always on my mind." Willie Nelson.
Yep.
So Sally feels like she has to go help Jillian. She rushes to her aid. Jillian has made sure that Jimmy was asleep so that they could run away together and escape him and his abuse. But he wakes up and holds them hostage in his car. Jillian lets Sally know that where to find the belladonna so that they can slip it in his liquor and put him to sleep.
Belladonna's in my bag.
Yes. But she's not paying attention when she's pouring it in. Plus, she's really nervous, and she pours in the whole package.
Not all of it, because some of it lands on the seat.
Oh, yes, there is that, yeah. But it was enough. It was enough to
kill him?
To kill him, to do whatever it was that killed him. Whether that's, like, stop his heart or his brain or what.
I was just making sure. I tried two different sites to see what the ring around the moon meant, and it said that my phone has been compromised.
So. Oh, no.
So there's maybe the ring around the moon is bad luck.
Yeah, there's a hex that's been put on your phone now. Okay, so I just wanted to say, so like they take him back to their house because they're like, what do we do with this? We've murdered this man. Well, we could try to bring him back to life using the spell that we're never, ever supposed to use. And I didn't even use to bring back my husband that I miss a whole bunch.
Because it would bring them back as something dark and unnatural. But Jimmy is already something dark and unnatural.
Right. They bring him back to life, right? They yes. accomplish what they set out to do, but they immediately kill him again. Which, like, you think that they might have had some, like, plan on, like, how to deal with this dark and unnatural man that was already dark and unnatural and murderous.
Right.
It seems like they didn't really put much thought into...
Yeah, I mean, shouldn't you have at least tied the body up first? Tied him to the table or something? But how long... You may not know this. I don't know why you would. But how long does someone have to be dead before the eyes look like that? He had no pupil. It was just...
You mean the cataracts?
Yeah. Yeah. When does that set in?
I have no idea, Chaney.
Because it seemed like he had just died and all of a sudden his eyes were cataracts and gross. Or maybe that was just part of him coming back to life. I don't know.
This has nothing to do with the cataracts, but it does have to do with the eyes. I wonder if there is something that didn't quite go right with their spell because they didn't stick the needles through his eyes. Mm-hmm. And that was a part of the spell.
It was.
And maybe that's why, like, all that happens later happens.
Well, that could very well be it.
I don't know. All I'm saying is they didn't complete the spell.
Right, because the ants even say you can't practice magic while sticking your nose up at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they kill him a second time with a pan to the head. And, yeah, Sandra Bullock did kill him twice. Jillian never killed him.
No, but he almost killed her twice. Three times by the end of the movie.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Multiple. Okay, so they bury him under the pergola, and roses start growing.
Beautiful roses.
Yeah, it's really strange to associate roses with something so terrible.
But they're prickly.
They are prickly. They're dangerous. Well, and Jimmy was pretty, but dangerous, just like the roses.
Exactly. That's a good connection.
But, you know, deep inside, he was a toad.
Yeah, the whole, like, frog thing, I like it. I'm not sure exactly why it happens. I feel like the roses make more sense than the frogs.
Well, I mean, they do say that he's squatting inside her like a toad.
Okay. All right. You always have a reason for everything. I like it.
And if I don't have one, I make it up and present it as truth.
As little gifts at my feet while I'm hanging upside down from the ceiling.
Exactly. Bats are monogamous. Look it up.
I wanted to point out that in Sally's shampoo store, mm-hmm. we have award-winning character actress Margot Martindale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I always like noticing her because she's great.
Yes, she is. Both of them are.
Yeah, both of them are really great.
And I honestly want to go into that store. It reminds me very much of Rose Apothecary from Schitt's Creek.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Both stores seem a little out of place for the town that they're in.
Yeah. But they also seem very, very zen and like they would smell amazing.
Oh, yeah. Never spent that much on shampoo in my life. I mean, I have, but... And I love the PTA scene.
Yes.
That is like one of my favorite parts of the whole movie.
Yes. When one of the ladies says something about Jillian and her folder snaps on her fingers and Sandra Bullock says, you shouldn't do that. And Jillian goes, I didn't do that. That was you that did that. And then Sally's name suddenly appears at the top of the call list and Jillian looks at her and says, now that was me. I love it. It's just, oh.
I just love that you know, they're in that room and they don't let the negativity of the other people in the room affect them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's such an inspiring scene. I love it. Now, the next thing that I have to talk about is the Midnight Margaritas scene.
Okay, let's bring it.
So I just want to say that it reminds me of our Goblet of Fire with Lindsay.
Uh-huh.
This was like years ago now, but we got, it was like, flower vases, right? that were shaped kind of like glasses, where it had like the bottom that you could put your hand around.
They were really pretty much full on planters, really.
Yeah, that we filled with triple sec tequila. And what's the other thing? What's the other ingredient in a margarita?
Margarita mix?
Isn't triple sec part of that?
Maybe. It depends on the margarita mix, I guess.
Well, anyway, it was like this thing that was bigger than any of our faces. And we put straws in there and just shared it and drank the entire thing.
Shout out to Cousin Lindsay. Love you. We need to do Goblets of Fire soon.
Yes. Goblets of Fire reunion.
Yes, Goblets of Fire reunion. And you know what? Do you know what we should do while we're drinking our Goblets of Fire? Once I can actually have alcohol again?
What?
Watch Practical Magic while we're doing it.
Oh my gosh, yes, that sounds like it sounds amazing.
Lindsay, let us know what you think.
Okay, so apparently in this scene, they all got actually drunk on bad tequila that Nicole Kidman brought.
So, reviewers, that was real.
Yeah. And apparently it wasn't just the actresses that were drinking. The whole crew took shots and they were dancing around.
That's amazing.
It seems like only really the director of photography did not partake. I mean, and really the Midnight Margarita scene is the iconic scene from this movie.
What a fun day on set.
Absolutely. Everybody participated. I mean, it just sounds great.
Although I do wonder if there was a recovery period after that, or if they're like, okay, well, this was fun. Call time is 4 a.m. tomorrow morning. Get ready for the next shoot. That would have been hard.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's impressive that we don't have the boom in any shot, or, you know.
They held it together.
Yeah. I mean, kudos, everyone.
Cheap tequila, man. That's woof.
But I do want to say that the end of that scene, when the aunt starts singing You Were Always on My Mind, and they have the mysterious bottle of tequila that's imbued with the spirit of Jimmy Angelov, is the creepiest part of the movie.
Someone left it on the porch.
Someone left it on the porch.
Yes, that's one of those moments where it goes, you get all those tinglies and your hair stands up. That moment, and when Evan Rachel Wood says, I don't want to go outside with him out there.
That's also pretty creepy.
And they're like, who? The man standing under the roses. There's no one there, but he's there.
You know, that actually is in the book.
Is it?
Yes.
Don't ruin it for me.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Spoilers?
Okay, so it's obvious that Jimmy Angelov is haunting them. I mean, his shoes come out of the ground just in enough time for them to see it before they sink back into the ground.
Right. Is he rising or is the floor sinking? Is this room actually stretching? A little Haunted Mansion for you.
Oh, I love that ride. But eventually, we've got the sheriff that rolls into town. Not the sheriff. Who is he?
Deputy? The cop?
A deputy. Some kind of person of official capacity that has a star badge.
Yeah.
Like a old-timey Western sheriff.
Yes.
So the deputy comes in town, and Sally finds out that she can't lie to him. There's just something about him, and she starts babbling, and she starts kind of telling the truth, but trying to keep herself from really telling the truth, and it comes out like, but she was basically kidnapped. I mean, just like a little nap.
But and then she has the worst taste in men. You do. But it's full on gibberish for about 15 seconds, and you're like,
just watching her flounder.
Get it together. Get it together.
Right. And it's so funny, like, having the two sisters there, because she is, like, losing it. And Jillian is embarrassingly trying to come on to the deputy.
Yes. And he is not having it for a second.
He's like, can I have my hand back now?
Okay. So we find out that it was Sally's letter that really brought him there.
Mm-hmm.
That he's read it several times. And he starts investigating and following them around, but really just following Sandra Bullock, not following Jillian. Then he comes over and Jillian is trying to get him to go away. So she gets the two little girls to help make a syrup with a potion in it to make him leave. Mm-hmm. And the girls find Sally's
diary
from when she was a kid, when she placed a spell to create a man that doesn't exist so that she would never fall in love. So as they're making the syrup, he comes over and he starts doing things that are in the diary, and the little girls are picking up on it and figure out that he is the man that their mother asked for. Mm-hmm. And they end up throwing the syrup in the ocean.
And cheering.
Because that's not suspicious.
No.
But, you know, kids are weird. And I love that Sally's like, I guess they didn't want to eat that.
Yeah, but unfortunately, right after that, they spot a single toad from 20 feet away. And somehow that draws their attention.
Well, to be fair, the frog is like... like choking and croaking at the same time.
And spits out Jimmy Angelov's infamous ring.
Yeah, and poor Nicole Kidman is not the greatest liar when it comes to improv. Oh, my ring. I was looking for this ugly piece of jewelry that obviously is mine.
Oh, you think it's Jimmy Angelov's ring, but actually, when we were together, he decided to make one exactly like it for me. A couple's thing.
Yeah. His is still on his body, I think.
His body. I mean his person, wherever he is.
Yeah, so the cop figures out that something's going wrong. You know, you ladies are lying. Get yourself some lawyers, because... I see what's going on. So then he leaves, and Jillian and Sally get into a fight. Sally decides that she's going to go and tell the truth. She leaves, and that's when Jillian, for the first time, has some sort of pang in her side. Mm-hmm. And you can tell something's not right with her physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then we follow Sally to the deputy's hotel room where she tries to confess. And then they end up making out. The natural order of things.
He's read her letter 1,000 times, and he's fallen in love with her through the letter.
When they're making out, and they end up on the bed, and then she pulls his face up, and she's like, one green eye and one blue.
It flashes.
I guess he's like looking from one eye to the other eye on her. Uh-huh. And when his eyes move, it flashes from blue to green, because they could not, I guess...
get a contact?
Did they not have contacts in 1998?
They absolutely did.
Colored contacts?
They absolutely did.
Maybe he couldn't wear them.
Maybe not.
It was really silly. That's the one moment that I'm like, come on, guys.
Ding.
Yes, it was the sparkling ring moment.
Yeah.
Except that was a choice that they made. This one, it just seemed like a lack of follow through.
Right. So Sally... gets a telepathic communication from Jillian, who is distressed. She runs, I guess, because she like leaves so abruptly that what is his name? Deputy Hawthorne.
With as many times as I've seen this movie, I don't know the aunt's names. I don't know his name, and I don't know the little girl's names.
Okay, whatever. So Deputy Star, he runs after her, I guess, because he ends up in the attic almost the same time that she does. I mean, he just kind of pops up out of there. And we see Jimmy Angelov's Snapchat filter ghost pop out of Jillian's body. Deputy Star is able to banish him with his star. Because
the symbol has power because you believe it does.
Right. Which is when they go outside and they talk about the curse.
Yes. And she says, the reason why you're here is because I asked for you here. When I was little, I made this wish that a man would come with all of these qualities that I didn't think existed, but you do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't stay because you don't know whether you actually feel this way for me. And I don't know whether you feel this way for me or if it was just the spell. And you will never know whether I'm asking you to stay because I just don't want to go to jail.
Yeah, but as he walks away, he kind of turns her words around on her. And she says, curses only have power if you believe in them. And I don't. Okay, so I've been waiting for this moment to talk about this weird thing that happened with the movie. The director found particular inspiration from this line with something that happened during the course of production. The director didn't know anything about witchcraft. So he hired a witch to consult on the movie.
Well, good for him.
Yes.
Being authentic. Okay.
I think it's awesome. Mm-hmm. I will preface this by saying I only have one side of the story, and it's from the people that worked on this movie. I don't know what the side of the story is from the woman that came and consulted. But I couldn't figure out how much she was originally paid. The director said it was quite a bit. But she asked for a percentage of the overall profits of the film. The producer told her that that wasn't possible, and she said, I'm going to place a curse on you and on this movie. Griffin Dunn, the director, later received a voicemail from her with more threats, and then she tried to sue the studio. The studio was so freaked out about all of it that they just paid her off.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did he put that line in after all of this?
It was hard for me to figure that out. The first time I read through everything, I thought that it had been written in because of that whole experience. But then when I read through it again, it seemed like he was inspired by that because he didn't want to believe that a curse could actually happen.
Huh. You know, I get it. You should get paid for your work. You should.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Absolutely. However, cursing the entire movie isn't really fair.
No, it's not.
Just, you know, curse the people that aren't giving you your just dues.
Yeah, they're the people that aren't being fair to you.
Be fair. Be fair to everybody. If you want fairness, give fairness.
Right.
But after that line, he turns back and he says, you know, I wished for you too. And then she cries, and then I cried.
You know, I feel like I'm usually the one that cries in these movies, and you're like, I'm emotionally separate.
This movie just gets me. Like I said, maybe it's the sister stuff. Maybe it's because I love you so much.
Well, there aren't a lot of sister narratives.
There's Frozen.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Frozen was a big deal when it came out.
You know, there aren't a whole lot of brother ones, too. There are some, like the new one that just came out.
Onward.
I was so glad that that one came out because kids don't really have a brother story, and that one was really, really special. So I think there should be more sister and brother movies.
Or just sibling movies.
Yeah.
Like, I think the main scene that we have left is the exorcism scene.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like the tone really matches with the dire circumstances that are happening, because all these ladies are showing up. They're like, are we having drinks? I brought a little vacuum!
It feels very Sabrina the Teenage Witch for a second.
It does.
Phone tree. But as soon as they walk into the living room and see Jillian, they're like, oh. This isn't the movie we thought we were in.
No. Where's the talking cat?
Yeah.
So I have something interesting about the scene.
Okay.
Nicole Kidman,
mm-hmm.
who just like really, really gives her all in this scene. She had grown accustomed at this point to doing multiple takes because of her experience with Stanley Kubrick in Eyes Wide Shut. And Stanley Kubrick was infamous for making actors cry because of insisting on like 75 takes per scene, which is just exhausting. So that's what Nicole Kidman was kind of coming off of. Apparently, like between the two actresses, Sandra Bullock was just do her scene like once or twice and be done. But Nicole Kidman did it over and over and over and over and over again. And so in this scene, she literally threw herself into it and was like slamming her head on the ground because she wanted to make it look real. So the production had to install rubber panels on the floor to protect her head.
Oh, wow. It's a little method.
Yeah, it is. It is.
To an extent, I want to put my whole physicality into something. However, if it's putting you in danger, then there are ways to make it so that it's not dangerous.
Right. When I was in high school, I was in Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None.
Mm-hmm.
The end, the villain grabbed me by the hair and threw me on the ground. And I wanted to make it look believable. So, I mean, I really allowed him to throw me on the ground. And I was getting huge bruises on my knees. It didn't occur to me that that's not something that you want to do.
Yeah.
I was just kind of like, I'm willing to do anything to make this good.
Right.
Yeah, it was before I really knew that you're supposed to, like, protect your body.
You live, you learn, and you get rubber floors.
Yeah.
They figure out that they need to lure Jimmy out with the tequila. In doing so, Sandra reopens the blood oath that she and Jillian had by cutting their hands and then putting them together. And the ladies all grab hands as well, completing the circle. And the spell, the curse for Maria, is broken. Jimmy is expelled from her body. And everyone erupts in laughter until Stalker Channing says, heads up, ladies. And Jimmy's spirit is above them in dust. And he falls to the floor. An eruption of dust flies up. And then time to clean house.
And then it becomes apparent why everyone had to bring brooms.
Yes. Sweep him outside. And then we're going to pour tomato juice on him.
And it's going to dissolve like acid.
Yes.
Like alien blood.
So everyone's happy again.
And everyone loves them now.
Yeah. Except one person isn't quite as happy as they could be. Our girl, Sally.
Because Deputy Star has gone away.
So she thinks on it, and then she wishes for him back. And he comes back, and they kiss. And then they all jump off the roof.
With umbrellas, yes.
It's a lovely Halloween tradition.
Yes, it is. And that's practical magic.
That's practical magic.
So I waited until now to let you know that there have been, like, a few attempts at making spin-off series of Practical Magic over the years.
Okay.
The first was in 2004, called Sudbury, and it was actually produced by Sandra Bullock, but the pilot was not picked up.
Okay.
The second was in 2010. ABC Family announced that they were making a spin-off series, but it never happened.
Hmm.
And most recently, however, Alice Hoffman released a prequel to Practical Magic called The Rules of Magic about the ants as younger women. And it has been optioned by HBO Max to adapt into a series.
Ooh, exciting. Okay. I like that. You said that Sandra Bullock tried to produce one. I don't know where she would pick up. Would it be with Sally and with Jillian, or would it be...
It kind of seemed like the pilot was like a redo of the movie. But like the scene that I saw was a scene between Jillian and Jimmy Angeloff.
That would have been interesting. I think that coming from the ants being younger is a more interesting angle. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love this movie, but I think that it's perfect as it is. I don't really think I need to know more of Sally and Jillian's story.
Mm-mm.
To me, it wraps up in a nice little bow.
Right.
But the ants are so, they're so wild.
They're mysterious. Like, what happened to them?
All the little anecdotes that they have here and there, the little stories that they have, dancing naked under the moonlight. The nudity is optional, as you well remember. Just like little things like that. It piques your interest and you're like, oh, they're really mysterious. I really kind of want to know what's up with them. So I think that that's a great take on it. So it would be really cool if that actually happens.
Yeah, I'm excited. And just to finish things off, I wanted to end with a quote from a interview with Stalker Channing.
Okay.
It says, it was really about the relationships of all these women, the aunts and the nieces and all that. That was Griffin's focus. We weren't playing witches. It was more like we were playing the relationships.
I think that plays.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. They're a fun family.
Yeah. Well, goodbye, Owens family.
Goodbye, the Owens family.
This was great.
It was. I love this movie. I love you.
I love you. What's next?
So next is our fan pick. And the heaviest response we've gotten is for Miss Congeniality.
The people have made their voices heard and we have listened. Is that how you say that?
Something like that. So we are going to step into the world of beauty pageants and in the shoes of the coppers and find that beautiful blend of Miss Congeniality.
All right. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Until then.
This has been Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts. Bye.
Goodbye.
Yee.